Did you hear the big news from Bahrain this week? The crown prince of the island nation won't be attending the upcoming royal wedding in London. But there hasn't been much news from inside Bahrain lately, even as the human rights situation there has deteriorated. We'll look more closely at Bahrain today. Popular protests began there in mid-February, another chapter in the uprising sweeping the region. In mid-March, Bahrain's king brought in Saudi troops to help put down the protests and declared martial law. At least 30 people have died in connection with the protests, and nearly 500 are believed to be in detention. Many prominent activists and lawyers are among them. And protesters who've been injured can't even go to the hospital because they'd risk arrest there, as do doctors who treat them. Faraz Sani is a researcher with Human Rights Watch. He recently returned from Bahrain.
You do not see large-scale protests in Bahrain the way that you did for the 3 or 4 weeks between February the 18th and, I would say, March the 16th. You just don't see that anymore because the security crackdown has been extremely severe by the security forces and by the military. And today what you see in Bahrain is, you know, the government has for the most part reestablished security. They claim that what they're doing now is trying to bring Bahrain back to a state of safety and security. But in fact, what we're seeing is a systematic crackdown on any form of dissent in the country. There is essentially a systematic campaign to go after anyone who is affiliated with the protests, anyone who is affiliated with opposition movements, you have large-scale firings or dismissals from jobs. You have students who participated in demonstrations having their scholarships revoked. I mean, this has gone well beyond a security operation to try to reestablish law and order in Bahrain. It is essentially a revenge campaign.
Human Rights Watch has documented that revenge campaign, including the recent deaths of 4 people in police custody. I asked Faraz Sani to explain why this tiny country has such strategic importance for its neighbors.
Bahrain is the only country in the Gulf that has a Shia majority that is ruled by a Sunni minority. The Al Khalifa family, who are Sunnis, have been in charge of Bahrain for the last 200 plus years. And the sectarian issue in Bahrain has been an issue from the time the Al Khalifas came into power until now. And there are also lots of other problems between the Shia and the Sunni. I mean, the Shia often claim that there is discrimination against them in employment, in housing, that they don't have key positions in government, and even though their power, you know, their numbers are larger than the Sunnis. And this sectarian issue, of course, invites a lot of other countries in the region to get involved in Bahrain. So even though Bahrain is a very small country, it actually becomes the playground in many ways for other regional players. As you know, the Saudis now have troops there. The Saudis are extremely sensitive to what happens in Bahrain because they are so close to Bahrain, and because they have their own Shia minority in the eastern region, which is right next to Bahrain. And the Shia in Saudi Arabia have been, have claimed that they have been systematically discriminated against for many, many years. And so when the Saudi government and the Saudi royal family saw what was happening in Bahrain and saw huge numbers of Shia coming out into the streets, some calling for the downfall of the regime of the Al Khalifa family, they completely panicked. And many analysts believe that there is no way that Saudi Arabia is ever going to allow Bahrain to have a Shia majority in power.
And what about Iran? Iran is accused by the Bahraini government of fomenting this protest. And it's funny when I look at the press coverage of Bahrain, it's the Iranian state news service that actually covers the protests there most closely and is really portraying this as a betrayal of the Bahraini people by the West, that the West is not coming to the defense of this Shia minority. How does the Iranian influence, I guess, or the rumors of Iranian influence play into this?
The Bahraini government is essentially, their narrative is that these uprisings are not popular uprisings. that they were very much fabricated and manufactured by foreign influences, including the Iranians and the Lebanese Hezbollah, and Shias in Iraq and elsewhere. They very much use this as a way to crack down on Shia, especially now. You know, if you look at their narrative, they essentially say, we are trying to reestablish law and security in Bahrain, and we're trying to make sure that all foreign influences, including Iranian agents or you know, Hezbollah agents, are rooted out of the country. This is all, in many ways, an attempt to kind of take the spotlight away from what the internal problems are in Bahrain, what the actual legitimate grievances of the Bahraini people, both Sunni and Shia, are against the government of Bahrain and against the Al-Khalifa family. I think what you said is probably most accurate. Rumors of Iranian influence. There is no doubt that the Iranians are using what is happening in Bahrain. And by the way, not only in Bahrain. I mean, if you look at their coverage of what happened in Egypt and Tunisia and many of these other countries, they essentially co-opt, or they try to co-opt, these revolutions and say that this shows that there is some sort of Islamic revival in the region. In fact, none of these uprisings or protests have had anything to do with Iran. These protests were popular protests that started as a result of grievances that Bahraini people have had against the government. Some of these grievances have been held by Sunnis. So in the beginning, when we were there to see a lot of the protests, there were many Sunnis who were part of the protests as well. And some of the opposition members are Sunnis and secular groups that have really no alliances per se with the Shia. So to claim that Iran has fomented this unrest is completely inaccurate.
Who are the protesters? Who were the protesters? And what do they want?
You had several thousand, and at some point probably more than 100,000 protesters on the street in one single day in Bahrain, which is an amazing thing to see, by the way, in any Gulf country. This was probably a first in the region. Different groups had different demands. The protesters, oftentimes the chants that you would hear from the protesters was "No Sunni, no Shia, only Bahraini," for instance. Sometimes you heard "Down, down, Hamad." Hamad is the king of Bahrain, King Hamad. Other individuals called for a real constitutional monarchy, something akin to what we have perhaps in the UK, where you have a figurehead who is in power, but the real power rests with the people in parliament. Right now, you have a parliament in Bahrain, but the parliament actually is not fully representative of the people's demands for various reasons. The king has a lot of power, and the king also has the power to appoint a second group of lawmakers that are essentially not accountable to the people. They are only accountable to him because he appoints them. So, you know, you had seven opposition groups. Some of them were Shia opposition groups. Some of them were secular leftists. Some of them were, not necessarily Islamist groups. Some were Islamist groups. You had a loose gathering, essentially, or coalition. So within that loose coalition, you had many different demands. But essentially, the largest and most cohesive demand of the opposition group was, we want real representative democracy in Bahrain. We don't, and some even called for a republic.
What's remarkable to me about Bahrain, about what you're saying you witnessed there, is that a fifth of the population came out to protest. Perhaps 100,000 people would be a fifth of the citizen population there. The numbers are more stark than any other country that we've seen in the Middle East, that there is just such a desire for change, and yet little change.
Yeah, that's, I think, one of the things that's deceiving, is that, in Bahrain, perhaps one of the reasons why it doesn't get the coverage that it should is that the numbers of deaths and maybe even the numbers of arrests, the total numbers, don't seem very large. But when you actually take the population of Bahrain into account, they are huge. And as you mentioned, when you have more than 100,000 people going out into the streets and protesting, I mean, more than 100,000 people was the estimate we had for one day. We don't really know. It's hard to estimate these things. But it was a huge number. Throughout the whole four-week period, you probably had more than 100,000 people that went out into the streets and protested. That is a huge percentage of the population of Bahraini citizens. So in many ways, this was very much a popular protest. This was not necessarily a sectarian issue. It was the demands of the people of Bahrain to the government of Bahrain.
With all of this, with essentially there being a popular protest movement that was shut down, a crackdown on really anyone who says anything against the government, what is the international community doing? Which government can put the most pressure on Bahrain, and is that government or are those governments doing that?
The international response to the human rights crisis, that's exactly what we see in Bahrain today, has been rather pathetic. Obviously, the United States is a very close ally of Bahrain. The U.S. 5th Naval Fleet is stationed in Bahrain. And as a result, the U.S. has very sensitive relations with Bahrain and also with the Saudis, who obviously have troops now who are essentially helping the government protect or, you know, reestablish security and safety in Bahrain. The European Union also has made some statements since the outbreak of violence on February the 14th. Their statements have been a little better than the statements that the United States has put out, but they also have been wholly inadequate. And we have plenty of evidence suggesting that the deaths were a result of excessive force being used by security forces. These were not accidents. And as a matter of fact, many of the deaths were caused by what I mentioned before, birdshot pellets, which are supposed to be non-lethal. But they become lethal when you shoot them from a meter away and you shoot them at people's heads. And that's how a lot of individuals have actually died in Bahrain, as a result of these birdshot pellets being shot at very, very close range. So the international response has been wholly inadequate. The United States has come out with one or two statements regarding arbitrary arrests and detentions, and also regarding attacks on the medical community. But in the past two or three weeks, we have not seen any real public statements from the United States and from the State Department, even though there have been plenty of visits from State Department officials to Bahrain, presumably closed-door sessions, where they claim that they are trying to encourage the Bahrainis to essentially let up on the crackdown. But again, no major public response from the Americans, a little better from the Europeans, but they could be doing a lot more.
That was Faraz Saneh of Human Rights Watch. For more about our work on Bahrain, visit hrw.org. And that's Rights Watch for today. Human Rights Watch is an independent organization dedicated to defending and protecting human rights around the world. For more about us, including audio, video, and multimedia features, please visit hrw.org. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Thanks for listening to Rights Watch. I'm Jesse Graham.